Chapter 5. Day 17. Mom. He returned to Charlotte, and Nicole went back to Erie. Within a few days, he was already considering a return to New York, as if being there would make it more likely that he'd stumble over the violin on a midtown street. Late one morning, as he was working through the Bach Chaconne for the third time, his phone rang. Alicia. He snatched it up. Any news? Did they find her yet? He laid down his bow on the music stand. The house echoed. Not yet. No one had tracked down the housekeeper. The community wasn't talking. What about the reward? Ray said. Did you tell them about the reward?
Oh, good idea, she said. Wish I'd thought of that sooner.
Darn, missed opportunity.
She couldn't just disappear, Ray said, pacing around the house.
What about airports, bus stations? It's New York.
Exactly, it's New York. She absolutely could.
He asked if there were any leads about the Bitcoin account. Nothing. The printer, nothing. Or the Chuck Taylor purchases. No news.
So Pilar is still the best shot, he said. She is. There is a serious manhunt out for her. Bill Soames promised to alert me immediately when they track her down.
I guess you haven't turned up anything with my family, then.
We're monitoring all their accounts. They've all been interviewed multiple times.
Alicia's voice turned deceptively casual.
I also had a chat with the Marks family.
Ray sat up.
What did you think? They're tripping, right? They're certainly a piece of work. Denied everything.
Well, Ray said, if the violin is gone, so much for their lawsuit against me.
They definitely don't seem to have a motive to steal it.
He parsed her words.
But you don't trust them either.
I don't.
But we haven't found any proof yet of their involvement. I'll keep you posted.
They hung up soon after, and Ray went back to practicing the Bach. He couldn't concentrate, though, and finally took a shower and lay on his bed, staring up at the ceiling. Mid-morning next day, Alicia texted.
Alicia, I found her, Honduras, the housekeeper.
Ray, I'm going down there. Send me the address.
Alicia, leave this to the pros, Grasshopper. I'm at the airport now.
Ray, are you sure it's her?
Alicia, pretty sure. We want to talk to her in person, not risk spooking her again. I'll report back ASAP.
Alicia called the next day just after 11 a.m. He'd barely slept, staring at the phone, willing it to ring or text.
I just left her, Alicia said. She says she doesn't know anything about the violin.
Why did she leave then?
She refused to say. Absolutely refused.
That's bullshit, Ray said. She must have said something. What made her disappear?
There's clearly something going on, Alicia said. But all she would say was that she was homesick. I kept asking her other questions, and that's all she'd tell me.
You speak Spanish?
Enough. And I hired a translator that I use when I travel to Central America.
After they hung up, Ray sat for a moment, thinking. Then he put the violin back in its case, went out to his car, drove the 40 minutes back down familiar streets. The house seemed exactly the same. Left gutter pulled away from the siding, rust stains oozing like acne down the white vinyl, new weeds elbowing their way through the old ones along the walkway. It felt so routine, like he was just returning from a trip to the grocery store, and so alien, like perhaps the grocery store had been on Mars. He knocked. For a few minutes, nobody answered, and he felt sick. He was stupid for not having called first. Ever since the twins finished elementary school, his mother's schedule had become erratic. It was the middle of the day, though. She should be home. He knocked again, hopeless now. Then he felt the slight rattle of footsteps, and a moment later, his mother stood in the doorway.
"Well, look who comes crawling back," she said. "Not so high and mighty now, are you?"
"Hi, Mom," he said.
"Now that you lost your fiddle, Guess you're wanting me to help you out, huh?
She eyed him.
Well, you might as well come in.
She sauntered back in, leaving the door ajar. The living room looked just the same. Faded couch, beaded lampshade, scuffed carpet, glass-topped coffee table. But what hit him hardest was the familiar smell. The slightly musty mix of old upholstery, unwashed sneakers, and nail polish remover. His mother sat grandly in her chair in front of the TV, gestured for him to sit across from her. He sat.
You stop sending money, she observed. You could have at least told me.
Nice to see you too. You got all the money in the settlement. I'm going to be paying you off for the rest of my life. Plus, I haven't been performing lately. I've been practicing.
Seems by now you should have gotten good enough to stop practicing.
He held his breath a moment, let it out. I have a big competition coming up in Moscow. It's one of the biggest competitions in the world. It's a pretty big deal.
Well, whoop-de-freaking-do,
she said, studying her nails, which were very white and glowed.
Shouldn't you be practicing then? Everybody else has been coming by asking me where I was. Did I know what happened to your fiddle? They got some kind of court order to look at my bank account. You know that. And not one word of apology from my son. Not one.
Why would I apologize? He said. The fiddle was stolen. The police were just doing their jobs trying to get it back.
You should have known it would have inconvenienced me.
She said the word like it was something she'd heard someone else say, then practiced in front of a mirror.
I was very inconvenienced. All these people coming by asking can they talk to me, scaring the twins. You know your sister didn't even want to let them in. You know that?
You and the family are the prime suspects, he reminded her, because of the money.
You think nobody else mentioned that, genius?
She was looking down at her chair, fumbling for her phone, which had chimed, so he was staring at the top of her head. Do you know who took it, Mom? Did Uncle Thurston? Uncle Larry? Because if it's about the money, I'll figure out how to get it to you. I just want the fiddle back. I don't care about the money.
You don't care about $5 million, she said. Sure you don't.
She was still groping in the chair for her phone, which she found, lifted to her face. Mom, he said again, trying to be patient. Just listen to me. If you know anybody who could have taken it, can you tell them to be in touch with me? I'll start crowdfunding. I'll get you the money.
How would I know where it is? She said. You got a lot of nerve, barging in here and accusing your mother of stealing that fiddle. You got some nerve, that's all I can say.
So you don't know where it is? And nobody else in the family knows anything?
You are getting on my nerves with this. Will you stop pestering me? I told you I didn't know nothing. Seems to me that those fancy white folks that are suing you would be the people you'd be thinking about right now, not the mother who fed you and clothed you.
The Marks family, you mean?
Yeah.
The detectives are looking into them, too. But I wanted to talk to you myself.
She picked up her phone. You know something? You gotta leave.
She stared into the depths of the phone screen, which looked blank from Ray's angle.
You need to go. Accusing your own mother. After all I did for you.
Mom, I... There was so much he wanted to say. He just looked at the top of her head, smooth and gleaming, as if she'd spent 20 minutes in front of the bathroom mirror, brushing her hair and pursing her lips. Got it, he said. Sorry to bother you. As soon as he got home, he logged onto the crowdfunding website he'd been clicking on for days, called Nicole. Hey, he said when she picked up. I think we should do the crowdfunding. She'd been after him to set up RaiseFiddle.com, a crowdfunding site to raise the ransom money himself, just in case the police or Alicia Childress didn't recover the violin on their own.
Okay, she said without hesitation.
What do you need me to do?
Together, they spent the afternoon and evening preparing the files and uploading photos under the heading, Please Help Me Rescue My Stolen Violin, with a donation goal of $5 million due by July 13th, 2 days before the ransom date.
This is gonna work, she told him. You're gonna have the money in no time.
I sure hope so, he said. But he already felt lighter and more confident. That evening, he struggled to get back into the mindset of practicing. The competition loomed. He was flying out in 2 weeks. He did his best to clear his head and focus on the Mozart fingering, on putting his whole soul and personality into telling Mozart's story, but he could feel that he wasn't emotionally connecting with the music the way he needed to. When the phone rang, he was grateful for the distraction, hoping it was Alicia with news about the former housekeeper. But it was Uncle Thurston. Wow, perhaps the talk with his mom was already working. He should have known his family had been involved. Hello? He said. What the hell you thinking, boy? Going over and threatening your mama? That's just bullshit, you hear me? He continued to swear so much that Ray couldn't even get a word in. I thought she raised you better than that. But what you need is to have someone take you outside and show you what happens when you threaten your mom. What are you talking about? I never threatened. Sure you didn't, Thurston cut him off. I don't want to hear your excuses. No excuse for that kind of behavior. How you turned out to be such a piece of shit is beyond me. It was always about you, wasn't it? You selfish son of a bitch. Always about you. Well, now the shoe's on the other foot, ain't it? I just called to tell you one thing. Just one thing. If you think for even a second we'll help you, any of us will help you get that fucking violin back. You can think again. You ain't never going to see that thing again. And you know what? I'm glad. You deserve what's coming to you. You earned it. Thurston hung up, and Ray, trembling, set down the phone. How had it ever gotten so awful? Part 2. The Joy of Family. 6 years ago. Chapter 6. The Wedding. October. One early October day in Ray's senior year in high school, he was sitting at the kitchen table watching Hilary Hahn's performance of Vivaldi's L'Inverno on his phone when his mother said from the doorway, Cheryl's son Ricky is graduating next month with his GED. He looked up, the violin soaring in his left ear. He had only one earbud in, so he could hear his mom if she wanted something. He hated hearing her yell. She got him a job working at the hospital, his mother was saying. A slender woman, she liked looking good, even now with her hair tied up in a scarf and wearing her favorite faded red T-shirt with Property of North Carolina State University Athletic Department on it. She leaned back against the door jamb, looked at her fake yellow nails with studied casualness. At the hospital? Ray repeated, not really listening. Hilary Hahn's fingering was delicate and impressive. He slowed down the replay, lifted the violin to his chin, practiced the fingering without letting the bow touch the strings. His mom didn't like him playing the violin in the house, even though he'd bought a cheap practice mute so she wouldn't hear it. Ray was the only kid in orchestra with a rental instrument, a beat-up ancient wreck, dirty and rough-sounding. He'd strapped a sponge with a rubber band to the violin's base to create a makeshift shoulder rest. The YouTube video swelled around him. His left arm was rigid. His right sawed the air. There were so many flats in the piece that he had to make sure his hand slid back into half position. Yeah, his mom was saying.
He's working in the cafeteria. He gets free food and benefits. Can't you graduate early?
He stopped, looked up at her.
What?
Why?
So you can get a job.
I have a job, he said. He rewound the video 20 seconds to examine how Han moved up and down the fingerboard. He hit pause and marked the music on the table in front of him.
Of course. Why was he trying to play that phrase in third position? Will you listen to me and stop with that noise?
His mother said.
That little part-time job ain't going to make you no money. Plus, it's over in a month. You gotta help out with these bills around here. You gotta make plans.
I think I missed the cutoff for the winter GED, he lied. I can check, though.
After Christmas, you're going to have to start helping with the rent and the rest of the bills.
She opened a cabinet door, stared at a row of cereal and pasta boxes, closed it. He set down his phone, actually looked at her. She was serious. Terror started out as a small nugget in his chest, quickly grew fingers, tightened like a hand around his heart.
You said before that I'd pay rent when I graduated. I changed my mind, she said. Ricky's already paying rent, and they just got a new 60-inch.
So you want me to get a GED so you can get a bigger TV? Is that what this is about? Regional orchestra auditions were in January, and Ray really wanted to try out. If he graduated in December, he wouldn't have the chance. It was a long shot to get in. But he'd spent the summer practicing, and he desperately wanted to try out. Only the top players in the state were chosen, and if he got in, he would be able to perform high-level music he'd probably never have another opportunity to play once he graduated and got a real job.
This is about you doing what I say and getting a damn job, she said.
She crossed back, opened the refrigerator, stared into it like she was reading his fortune in the packed shelves.
You could have been making good money at Popeye's by now.
I don't want to work at Popeye's or in the hospital cafeteria.
I didn't ask you what you wanted.
She poured out a liter of soda.
I told you to get a real paying job, you hear? You had plenty of time to find another one by now. You better have a job by Thanksgiving.
His part-time job at the construction site ended next month. She poured herself a glass of soda.
I'll find something, he said.
Maybe the grocery store?
You need to go ahead and apply, she said, and go check about getting your GED.
She took her soda back to the living room, where she and the twins were watching TV. The twins, who had just celebrated their 8th birthdays, were, like his mom, addicted to Family Feud. Ray put in both earbuds, turned Vivaldi's L'Inverno up as loud as it would go, pressed play. He would ignore everything except the music. Hopefully, his mom would forget about the GED by the end of the weekend, but that wasn't likely. Once his mom got an idea in her head, there was no shaking her. She wanted that 60-inch. He'd applied to the grocery store on Monday after school. The hours were pretty much the same as the construction site, plus it was indoors. Satisfied that he had a workable plan, he spent the rest of the weekend focusing on playing L'Inverno on his school violin and playing a new video game on the PlayStation 5 his grandma Nora had given him last Christmas. But that Monday in orchestra class, Ray's buddy Aiden changed everything. Before class started, Aiden sat down 2 seats over from him, leaned in and asked,
"What are you doing this weekend?"
They'd become casual friends the year before, eating lunch together and playing duets sometimes at Aiden's house. If Ray ever needed to borrow rosin or an extra string, Aiden was the only one who would offer. Aiden was tall and slim, with long black hair that he was constantly brushing out of his eyes. He was one of a handful of Asian kids in orchestra.
Not much. Studying? Chilling?
Can I borrow your rosin? Ray asked. Aiden handed it over. Ray unscrewed the lid, applied the rosin to the bow hair with long, slow strokes. I got asked to play a wedding on Saturday, Aiden said. The other violinist just backed out. You want to take his place? It's $200. For a moment, Ray couldn't breathe. Are you serious? Quit fucking with me, dude. Aiden laughed. I'm dead serious. We need another violin. It's an outdoor wedding. We get to stay for the reception. Free food. Want to do it? Fuck yeah, I do. Ray calculated. $200 was like 25 hours of minimum wage at the construction site or bagging groceries. 2.5 weeks of work. Good, Aiden said. I'll get you the music after class. Wait till his mother heard. She called his music noise, but once she heard how much money he could make, she'd change her tune. No need to bag groceries. If he could get a regular gig playing music, he'd be golden. At the end of class, when Aiden handed him the music, Ray said as casually as he could, You have any more gigs lined up you might need me for? Yeah, we do a few a month. Don't you have a job, though? It's ending in November, Ray said. I would love to play with you guys. Who was the other violinist? It's Chad Horner. You know him? Graduated last year. He's a flake. This is the third gig he's bailed on. I should have asked you earlier. It's just you're always working. Ray didn't want to sound desperate. I'm usually free most weekends. Awesome, Aiden said. Let's see how this weekend goes. If it's good, you're in. When Ray got home that evening, he immediately hunted down his mother, who was in her bedroom, lying back against the pillows, flipping through Essence magazine, phone tucked almost invisibly beneath her jaw. Hold on, she said into the phone. What is it? She said to Ray. I'm making $200 this weekend. He had never made that kind of money. Even if his mom took most of it, what would he buy? If he had two gigs, he could buy his own violin. No more school instruments. He could get a shoulder rest instead of a sponge. He'd seen one for $25 at the music store in Providence Road. Where? I'm playing at a wedding. It pays $200. He rolled the numbers around his tongue, savoring them. Oh, good. Then into the phone. What I want to know is, does she really think he don't notice? Because he sure as hell noticed. That's like 2.5 weeks of work bagging groceries, Ray said. Maybe she didn't understand. That's just like her, his mom said. I told you she was going to do something like that. If I do a good job, Ray said, they said they can use me every week. That's $200 a weekend. That's more than Ricky makes at the hospital in 1 week. Hold on, girl, she said to the phone. She stared up at the ceiling. He makes about $300 a week. Yeah, but that's working 5 days a week. This is one afternoon. If I can get a couple gigs a week, and my friend thinks I can start bringing in serious money. When you get paid? After each gig, he said. One thing, though. I'm going to need a ride. She looked at him blankly. Well, you're going to have to find one. I'm not your taxi. Ride your bike. She gestured for him to be quiet, waved him out. He turned, muttering, You are unbelievable, and hit the doorframe with his shoulder. Hold on, girl. What did you say? She shouted behind him. Nothing. I didn't say anything. He went down the hall, flopped down on his bed. For a few moments, the old familiar resentment seethed through him. He needed to save up for a car, that was clear. Then he could book even more gigs. Then she'd see how much money he could make with his playing. And he could stay in school, try out for regionals. He'd get paid for making music. This was incredible. He texted Aiden, asked him for a ride to the wedding, then rummaged through his book bag to retrieve the wedding music. Canon in D. No problem. Arrival of the Queen of Sheba. No problem. Water Music Suite. They sure were playing a lot of Handel. He was reaching for his violin when his mom opened the door without knocking. Let me tell you something, she told him.
when I'm on the phone, don't come in asking me anything crazy. Do you understand?
Ray held his breath for a moment. Okay, he said at last.
And don't even start playing that thing, making all that noise.
He needed a better practice mute, he told himself again. He'd pick one up once he made his first $200. He shuffled the pages around until she left. Then he just read and reread the music until he fell asleep, imagining how amazing it would be playing in a wedding, a real wedding. By Saturday morning, the 12 pieces of music were creased and parts were almost illegible with handling. His fingertips thrummed with anticipation. He took out the polish that Aiden loaned him, rubbed it vigorously on the violin's body to try to clear off decades of rosin buildup. By the time he'd finished, his right hand was sticky and white with the rosin. He was so determined to make a good impression that he even polished the back of the violin, though no one would actually see it. He wiped his hands on the edge of his bed, leaving a smear of rosin behind. Now for the suit. Black slacks, stiff white shirt, black tie. He looked at himself in the mirror. Damn, he looked good. People might think he was the one getting married. As he took his cereal bowl back to the kitchen, his mom came out of her room. Why are you so dressed up? I'm playing that wedding today, remember? I told you I'm not giving you a ride. I know. I took care of it. He put the bowl in the sink and retreated to his room to grab his jacket and his violin case, dashing outside as Aiden showed up, right on time. At 11:15, 15 minutes early, they pulled up to the wedding venue. Ray had passed this place dozens of times, but never thought that the wrought iron gates would stand open and welcoming for him, that the tall brick pillars, weathered a soft pink, would allow him to enter. At the top of the drive, people were getting out and heading up the walkway to the front door. Aiden pulled up behind them.
You go on in. I'll park and meet you around back.
Okay, cool. Ray grabbed his violin case and headed up the sidewalk, lined with huge gray ceramic vases from which ivy and roses poured. The house was even more daunting up close. It seemed to go on forever. He was really doing this. Slightly ahead of him, a young couple and a young woman were dressed in their Sunday best, the young man in a navy blue suit, the women both in mini dresses. Their wedding gifts, wrapped in silver, sparkled. Hi, he said. The people smiled with their lips, their eyes not meeting his. The man, blonde and blue-eyed, rang the doorbell. This was it. His first paying gig. He was on his way to the big time. He'd hand his mother the crisp $20 bills, and she'd look up at him and smile and hug him. Maybe they'd even give him two $100 bills. The door knocker was enormous, ornate, fashioned in the shape of an open-mouthed lion. Was it brass? Gold? He couldn't wait to tell his mom about this place. She wouldn't believe it. He was about to take a photo to prove it to her when a tall man with a foamy white beard and a speckled bald head opened the door. He looked at all of them, looked twice at Ray.
Hey, Uncle Roger, said the young woman next to him,
a redhead with heels so high Ray didn't know how she could even walk.
You look fantastic.
She offered him her cheek. Uncle Roger was wearing a tuxedo. Ray had never seen a tuxedo up close. Could Ray take a picture of the tuxedo, too? He was a big dude, probably a football player 30 years ago.
Melanie, Uncle Roger was saying, we didn't think you were going to make it. Sarah will be thrilled that you're here.
Ray waited for the man to turn to him. Instead, he said to the couple,
Mike, Ellie, so glad you could come today. Come on in. Everyone is in the living room for drinks and hors d'oeuvres.
Uncle Roger leaned to one side, and the three entered, Melanie teetering in on her heels. Ray was next.
May I help you?
Uncle Roger stepped out of the doorway.
Hi, I'm here for the wedding.
Uncle Roger looked Ray up and down.
Whose wedding?
I'm playing for your wedding, Ray explained.
I'm sorry, you are... Ray kept his smile fixed in place.
I'm Ray McMillan, playing for the service.
Hold on a minute.
Uncle Roger stepped back through the door, partially closing it. Ray could still hear him.
Anne, could you come here?
Aiden was nowhere in sight. A few more cars had pulled up, new guests with new presents. The conversation on the other side of the door was still unspooling.
Well, who is he? Uncle Roger was saying.
I don't know, a woman's voice. Did you ask him for an ID?
No. He was carrying something. I guess it could be an instrument.
We don't have time for this. I have to finish getting ready. It's almost time to move everyone to the garden.
Well, what do you want me to do? Uncle Roger said. I don't know who this kid is.
Ask him for an ID. Maybe he's with the catering company.
They all arrived at 10. It's 11:30.
You're going to handle this. For once in your life, can you make an effort?
The door opened partway, the man's face barely visible.
I think you have the wrong address. This is a private ceremony.
Ray couldn't even open his mouth to speak as Uncle Roger closed the door.
What just happened? Did that guy just close the door on him?
Ray stood there in his black suit with his black tie, in his polished black shoes, looking dope with his fresh new fade, with his violin polished and his bow rosined, and the whole world waiting to hear him play. And he just stood there. This had to be a mistake. He was carrying a violin case, for goodness sake. Who shows up to a wedding with a violin case and has the door slammed in his face? He rang the bell again. It was 11:26 a.m. The other wedding guests were tapping up the walkway. A blonde girl dressed like a 30-year-old, with a dress that barely covered her hips, looked directly at him and then looked away. She was probably 15, if that. She was the only one who even looked at him. Uncle Roger was opening the door and waving the other guests inside, his body somehow blocking Ray from entering. Ray could hear the sounds of forks on plates and low laughter.
Come on in, everyone. We're about to go into the garden.
I'm supposed to be playing, Ray said,
holding up the violin case as if there was a sign emblazoned on it, here to play for wedding.
Should he call Aiden? He would, but he was so embarrassed, as if he'd done something wrong. Maybe he had and just didn't know.
Uncle Roger gently but firmly closed the door again.
What the hell?
The door opened, and Uncle Roger looked directly at him. Ray sighed, relieved. 11:31. He moved as if to enter.
Look, you're going to need to leave before I call the cops. This is a private event.
What? I'm supposed...
Uncle Roger lunged toward him.
This is a wedding, not a rap concert.
What are you talking about? I'm here to play at your wedding.
I booked a string quartet. It's classy. No offense, but it's not your people's kind of music.
I'm here to play.
I'm not going to tell you again, Uncle Roger said. Get the hell off my property now.
Again the door slammed, louder this time, cutting off the din inside. From across the lawn, a bird sang, loud in the stillness.
What the actual fuck?
He called Aiden, who answered almost before the phone rang.
Dude, where are you? We were supposed to start 5 minutes ago. You haven't even gotten set up yet. Did you get lost? You won't believe this, but I can't get in. What? What are you talking about? Some guy told me I was at the wrong place and slammed the door in my face. Are you serious? Where are you now? I'm at the front door. Hold on, I'll come get you.
11:36. 11:39. The door opened again.
Dude, hurry up!
Aiden led Ray through the empty foyer. Uncle Roger had thankfully disappeared. Ray caught a blurred glimpse of oriental rugs, heavy wooden and gilded furniture, and pictures in heavy gold frames suspended from wires on the walls. They sprinted through a pair of French doors and into the garden, slowed to a walk. Garlands of roses and white lilies looped like snakes along the walkways. Twin fountains sprayed a light mist. The sunlight fell golden and in rainbows. Ray and Aiden tried to tiptoe inconspicuously around the two rows of padded white folding chairs, now holding wedding guests. Most people ignored them, but Ray could feel some eyes, like flies on him, clinging. The other musicians were sitting on one side under a tent. Four chairs, two empty. Ray sat down. What had just happened? Aiden grabbed Ray's folder.
Go quick as you can. I'll get your music ready. We're starting with water music.
Beth Lamb was playing viola, and Christine Long was on cello.
I'm sorry, man. It wasn't my fault. I tried to. Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out later. You guys ready?
They gave a nod and waited for Aiden's cue. It felt as if every eye in the garden was on Ray. He wondered where Uncle Roger was, if he'd march over and drag Ray out. He told himself to calm down. It was no big deal. This was the first of many gigs. He needed to do it right. $200. The music started. Suddenly, his bow arm was gliding across the strings, and his fingers were making the notes somersault off the fingerboard. He was doing it. He was actually playing music and getting paid for it. People were listening to him, and paying him for the privilege. This was more fun than he'd had ever. He loved the immediateness. The melodies sluiced off the violin and out into space where he was setting the mood and filling his audience's senses. The quartet played through the five prelude pieces flawlessly. These were all songs they'd played many times in class, and all four of them knew the music from memory. At the end of the fifth piece, the groom, minister, and four groomsmen took their positions beneath the canopy in front of a wall of white roses. The wedding director waved at Aiden to begin music for the next processional, Rosa Medre, prelude on a Welsh hymn tune, for the family's entrance. This was one of Ray's favorites. He liked it so much that he'd researched the piece and the composer, Ralph Vaughan Williams. The title meant lovely. It was totally, absolutely true. The sun was high in the sky. The air was cool but not chilly. Every flower in the garden was in bloom. The guests were no longer looking at him. They'd all turned to watch the mother of the bride in a sky blue dress glide down the white runner that ran between the rows of seats. She walked in perfect sync with the music. The bridesmaids, in darker blue satin gowns, with their hair elaborately piled on their heads, followed. Then Christine played the eight most familiar notes in all of classical music, Pachelbel's Canon in D. As she played, the house's elaborately carved French doors opened, and the bride appeared. Standing next to her was Uncle Roger. Ray's hands froze. He doubted he'd be able to move the bow, to lift the violin. He would stick there, become part of the chair itself. Aiden began to play. Ray had only eight beats of rests before he had to enter. Those eight beats stretched on and on. He stared at the music, convinced that Uncle Roger was glaring at him. No matter what just happened, his first gig was going to be a good one. This was the start of something great. Right on cue, as if his hands belonged to someone else, he began to play. His phrasing was even and sure. His notes were rich and beautiful. Aiden looked over at Ray, nodded in approval. Roger and the bride drew closer, and Ray drew more into himself, focusing on the music. He was sure Uncle Roger was marching down the aisle, glowering at him. But when Ray dared to glance up, Roger was focused on the minister and the groom and the bridesmaids. When the bride took her place, Aiden signaled them to stop playing. They wouldn't play again until the minister announced the couple was officially married, and then they'd start in on Arrival of the Queen of Sheba. Ray kept his eyes on the music, on the few feet of grass that separated them from the guests. Listen to the vows. Finally, Aiden brought his instrument to playing position.
"And now," suggested the minister, "may I present Mr. and Mrs. James Sinclair."
Ray was poised, ready, but just before the first note, his eyes locked with Uncle Roger's, lower lip clamped in his teeth, scowling at him from the front row. Ray was a professional. He wouldn't let the old man psych him out. He kept his eyes on Uncle Roger and began playing Arrival of the Queen of Sheba. The fast notes didn't deter him from the staring contest. He'd gone over the piece so many times that he no longer needed the music. Then Beth's hand slipped from the viola's fingerboard, and she played a series of wrong notes. Uncle Roger stood up to applaud the new husband and wife. They were almost done with the ceremony, and soon he'd never have to see Uncle Roger again. And most important, he'd played beautifully, the beat-up old violin singing like a Stradivarius. The $200 was his. The guests and Uncle Roger followed the couple from the garden back to the house. The quartet had been invited to eat at the reception, but Ray was still on such a high from playing that he didn't much care if he ever ate again. They packed up their instruments and music while the cleanup crew took down the canopy.
"Man, you sounded awesome," Aiden told him. "I didn't know you were such a rock star."
Beth overheard them as she packed up her viola.
"You really are a great player. Where'd you get that violin?"
Ray laughed.
"This is one of the school rentals." "Are you serious? It sounded really sweet. You did a good job."
"My man."
Aiden wrapped an arm around Ray's shoulders. Ray's chest expanded with pride. Of course Aiden would ask him for more gigs. No bagging groceries or getting a GED. Just then came a voice from behind them.
"Thank you so much. You sounded wonderful."
They turned. The mother of the bride was bearing down on them. Behind her, eyes fixed on Ray, was Uncle Roger.
"Thank you for having us, ma'am."
Aiden slung his violin case over his shoulder.
"We really appreciate it. Sarah was so happy with the music. We look forward to seeing you inside. Roger will take care of you."
"Okay, so what do I owe you?" Uncle Roger said, as if he didn't know.
Ray leaned over to watch. This was it. The moment he got paid for his first gig.
$800, Aiden said. Ray could barely keep a goofy grin off his face as Uncle Roger reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a thick wad of folded bills. "Thank you all," the mother of the bride was saying. "Please follow me to the dining room and join us for the reception. Sarah and James will want to thank you personally. Roger?"
A flurry of thank yous followed. Uncle Roger extended one hand, stepped aside. Aiden led the quartet down the white runner toward the French doors. Ray was about to follow them when Uncle Roger grabbed his arm. The mother of the bride, leading the rest of the quartet, was now several steps ahead. Uncle Roger scowled at him, rage barely contained. In that moment, Ray saw something both familiar and foreign. He'd seen that same expression dozens of times from dozens of people. The men on the corner on his way to work, the cashier at the 7-Eleven, the police officer riding by on patrol, Mark Jennings in orchestra class. He knew that expression. Uncle Roger pulled him in closer, never breaking his gaze.
"You almost destroyed my daughter's wedding."
The only reason I didn't throw you out is because I didn't want to cause a scene, he growled. I want you to get the fuck out of my garden and get the fuck out of my home. I don't ever want to see your face around here again. Fucking darkies need to stay on your own side of town. You are going to walk your black ass through those doors and off my property. If you so much as cough, I'm calling the cops. Do you understand me, boy? Ray's mind was blank. How had Ray almost ruined the wedding? Maybe he'd missed a couple notes, but nobody cared. Beth had played worse than him. He couldn't breathe. Uncle Roger jerked Ray's arm, waited for Ray to pass, and fell into step behind him. Ray felt daggers in the back of his skull. There was no possibility of going into the dining room, grabbing a plate of food, sitting with the others, basking in a job well done. He'd wait for Aiden in the car, if he could find it. A few yards away from the house doors, an older man with an unkempt mustache smoked a cigarette. As Ray passed, the man said to Uncle Roger, "Niggers are getting bold, ain't they?" Ray froze for an instant, his stomach in his throat. Behind him, the man and Uncle Roger laughed. Ray reached the house. From his left, he could hear the sound of conversation, the clink of forks, laughter.
"Straight ahead, boy."
The house enveloped him. His eyes burned. Again, a blur of lush furnishings, even more blurred now. At last, he was in the foyer. He recognized the big carved door, open, the ornate golden lion staring at him emptily. Wordless, he walked outside and down the walkway. He'd wait for Aiden past the gates on the road. Or maybe he'd get an Uber. He couldn't stand to be on this property a moment longer. There are moments in life when the clouds lift and the curtain of rain blows back, and suddenly the world stands before you, stark and vast, and you teeter on the edge of an enormous precipice of knowing, of understanding, with every fiber in your soul, every hair on your head. And this was one such moment. A little breeze came from nowhere and set the early autumn leaves spinning, green, gold, and yellow, and the air felt like it was being breathed by different lungs. The leaves on the ground, crunching under different feet. It's not that he didn't know he was black, of course he did. A glance at the back of his hand was a constant reminder. And it's not that he didn't realize that there was racial prejudice in the world. It was baked into every TV show, discussed ad nauseam in the news, marched against and preached against. So how was it possible, how was it even conceivable, that he would somehow believe that racism didn't apply to him, that white people would just ignore his skin? He was dressed in a suit, with a nice tie, and he spoke with the same accent they did. His handshake was firm, and his gaze direct. He knew he had a great smile on the rare occasions when he smiled. He wasn't the smartest kid, but he was smarter than most. And none of that mattered. No matter how nice the suit, no matter how educated his speech, or how strong the handshake, no matter how much muscle he packed on, no matter how friendly or how smart he was, none of it mattered at all. He was just a black person. That's all they saw. And that's all he was. He would always, always be seen as only half as good as everyone else. All this time, he'd lied to himself. Or had he just been naive? Mr. Stinson, that jerk of a music teacher, didn't ignore him because Ray was poor, couldn't afford an instrument, couldn't afford private lessons like all the white kids did. No, Mr. Stinson ignored him because he was black. Mark Jennings, the only other really good player in the orchestra, called him ghetto and taunted him, not because Mark Jennings thought of Ray as a rival, but because Ray was black. Being black was why Aiden had never asked him to play before, because why would you want a reliable black guy when you could sit around waiting for an unreliable white one? Black people just couldn't play this kind of music. Ray was ridiculous to think that he could. Everything written by James Baldwin and Langston Hughes and Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and all the other writers that he'd read in school was true. Racism was real, and it was about him. Today he had learned two things, and these two things were intertwined in his head and in his life. First, he learned that he could make money playing in front of an audience, and that he loved playing in front of an audience. His listeners spurred him to play better, to dig deeper inside himself, to trust his fingers and their innate sense of where the music wanted to go. Second, he learned that doing what you loved may not be enough, that all the passion and perseverance that roared like blood within you could be trumped by factors that you could never control. Factors like the color of your skin, or the shape of your eyes, or the sound of your voice. The world had been telling him these things over and over, and he'd just been too dumb to hear it. Finally, after walking for months, for decades, he reached those elaborate wrought iron gates that he had passed a billion years before. Only then, when he'd returned to the world, with cars thundering past, and a 7-Eleven on the corner advertising $1.50 Slurpees, and an open late Wendy's just beyond that, did he sit down on the curb and text Aiden. Outside gate. Pick me up on your way out. He'd get that $200 to show his mother.